Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your host, Kevin Pelton, and it's been 25 years since the Seattle Supersonics reached the 1996 NBA Finals. Today, we remember that magical run with the head coach of that team and now the co-host of the Truth in Basketball podcast. Please welcome to the Pelton Cast, Coach George Karl.
Kevin, thanks for having me. No problem at all. I like to celebrate 25 years. I'm still trying to figure out why we don't have a celebration, but it must be COVID-led that we kind of didn't have a party. But I know a couple of my guys are trying to figure out how to have some fun up there sometime this year or next year sometime.
Yeah, definitely well-deserved. It's a great time to look back on it. I will say, though, that, you know, kind of the story of that season, I think, begins in the disappointment of the previous two playoff runs, the losses to Denver in the first round in 94 and then the Lakers in 95. And one of the big questions coming out of the second series is whether you were going to remain head coach. And I feel like if that had happened today, you look at, for example, what happened to Dwayne Casey in Toronto, who was an assistant on that team. I think there probably would be a coaching change today. But back then, after a couple of weeks, Wally Walker as GM and president makes the right call to keep you on. What were those couple of weeks like for you, just kind of not knowing?
Coaching in the NBA, you kind of have to block out the noise about your job. You want to be liked. You want to be appreciated. And, you know, we won a lot of games. And then expectation goes from winning in the regular season to winning in the playoffs. And, you know, I've been a student of playoff basketball for over 30, 40 years. And no one in management wants to hear the truth. The truth is it's hard to win. It's hard to win four playoff series in one round, in one year. And that's why it's the greatest, probably most difficult championship in basketball, in sport. I mean, no one has to win four. I mean, I think baseball has three, but I'm not sure. Football has four games, but not 28 games.
Right.
Playoff basketball is an incredible mental challenge, physical challenge, and emotional challenge. And, you know, the one year we lost that, you know, got upset by Denver, we were an emotionally immature basketball team. And then Tacoma, the Lakers might have been better than we were. The Lakers were a good basketball team that year, and we're playing 82 games on the road. But management don't want to hear the rationalizations. They want results. And our country, our sport world, is so much into championships that you're a bad team or a bad coach if you lose. And that's not the case. I mean, we were a good team before we got to the finals, and we were a good team after we got to the finals. Now, you might not like the results, but the truth is, too many times the results create mental craziness. And it's all over the world. Don't get me wrong. The soccer world is probably worse than the NBA basketball yes. world. But, you know, the NBA basketball world is pretty crazy.
For sure. For sure. Now, it wasn't the exact same team that comes back in 95, 96. Some key changes. And I think that starts with, you know, you and Kendall Gill obviously were having issues at the end of the 94-95 season. And I was amused at reading back the Seattle Times archive. When Kendall Gill was informed that you were coming back as head coach, he told the beat writer Glenn Nelson of the Seattle Times, "It's been nice knowing you." So I think he knew that a trade was in the offing, and you end up working a great one to get Hersey Hawkins as well as David Wingate from Charlotte in return. What did that mean to you as a coach and to the Sonics as a team?
I mean, it was one of the best trades I think I've ever been associated with from a standpoint of getting rid of a player that did not fit and getting a player that did fit. I mean, Kendall was, you know, okay, you can blame it on me. You know, you can blame it that he and I just didn't mix. But the truth of the matter is he didn't mix with almost anybody on our team. I mean, he had I mean, Gary and him didn't get along. Sean and him had a cold relationship. He was kind of a young, cool cat, you know, that just didn't hit the vibe when he walked in that locker room in training camp. I don't know if he made a jump shot for like a week. You know, he was pressing. He wanted to show the world that he wanted to be here and wanted responsibility. And he played poorly. And what's kind of funny about the whole thing, he didn't play very well all year long. And then he plays the only guy that played pretty well in the Denver series.
Right.
When we got upset. I mean, he actually had a very good fifth game and had a pretty solid playoff series in that year. Players always, think coaching and their relationship with the coach is personal. And I think Kendall was sensitive to the personal, discomfort that he was probably feeling. I wish it would have worked out better because I thought he was a good player. But he was kind of in competition with Gary and Sean. And Gary and Sean were young players at that time, searching for their territory of all-star, their territory of branding themselves as one of the best players in the NBA. And there might have been a little bit too much, ego for the spotlight of the Seattle Supersonics. Gary wasn't going to give it up. Sean wasn't going to give it up. And Kendall wanted some of that. And so it just kind of festered and it maybe grew some. But then when Hersey came in, Hersey's a quiet guy, a classy guy, a communicative guy, a team guy, and he loved it. He came here and he fell in love with, being a third or fourth fiddle. He didn't care who got the glory. He just wanted to win.
Yeah, a perfect fit, at that stage of his career, and then the outside shooting he brought. And one of the things you've mentioned is his defense surprised you in Seattle.
The one thing I loved about coaching in Seattle was we had guys that demanded you play defense. I didn't have to demand it. And we had Bob Kloppenberg, who wanted every possession to be perfect. And, I'm kind of a defensive guy. At least back then, I was definitely a defensive guy. Tim Gerger is just a defensive guy. All our coaches probably tilted more towards being defensively focused and offensively focused. And he came in and, Gary and Nate and Vincent, I think Vincent Askew was still on the team. And we would have fights on the bench. Hey, if you're not going to cover the mother, I'm going to cover the mother. It worked, If a guy went off on us and got going, we had guys on our team that wanted the responsibility of shutting them down. It was great. And what Hawk became was the guy that always started on the best player because we wanted to protect foul trouble situations. And then we just, as the game went on, we decided who we wanted to put on who when the game was on the line.
And then also some changes on the bench. Sarunish Marshallonis, someone else who had probably been unhappy with playing time, goes to Sacramento along with Byron Houston for Frank Borkowski, who provided you another veteran and piece of the puzzle. And then I mentioned Wingate as part of that Charlotte trade, and then Eric Snow coming in the second round. Those are, three guys you've mentioned were adaptable teammates.
Of all my years of being successful, the years where we were probably overachieving and went for as far or farther than people thought we were going to do, the end of the bench being happy was a part of the personality. And I figured we had Eric Snow and I think David Wingate, and I forget who else at the end of the bench. We had one other guy.
Obviously Scheffler.
Oh yeah. Scheff. And then Borkowski is a clown. Yeah. Like a guy that likes to pull pranks and keep everybody loose. And Borkowski played more, but those other guys, they were great. I mean, they had to put up with a lot of crap in practice. They had to put up with me coaching them, Matt Angerley, to tell Gary how he's got to start playing the right way. And I remember Eric Snow. I love Eric Snow because, I mean, we had Nate, Gary, and Greg Anthony and Eric Snow. Eric Snow was never going to play. I mean, we had three pretty damn good point guards, NBA point guards. And Eric, as a young player, is trying to figure out the league. And I'm going, Eric, I think you can play in the league, but you're probably not going to play here. And that was probably the happiest moment of me making a trade is when we traded Eric Snow.
Yeah, and it worked out for both sides. Obviously, he went on to be part of that finals team in Philadelphia, also a finals team in Cleveland. But you got a draft pick that one of those picks ended up being used down the line on Rashard Lewis. So worked out well for both sides. One of the things you mentioned in one of your books I was surprised by is saying that, you know, about that 95-96 season in particular, that it was important as a coaching staff to give more of the game over to Sean and Gary. And they were already all-stars by that point. But Sean in particular took it to a next level that season. Gary played well enough to make the Olympic team after that season. What kind of change did you see from them at that point?
You know, I think I, like almost most coaches, like relying upon more veteran, responsible pros. And Gary and Sean, you know, had their little things that always pissed me off. Or, you know, Sean was more that he didn't have a lot of time management responsibilities. Gary just had a kind of bad attitude, or not a bad attitude, but just a edgy attitude in the mornings when we practiced. And you know, sometimes I could put up with it. Sometimes I lost it. But my coaches convinced me that I was being too hard on them. And I said, they kind of convinced me that if I was going to demand more from them, I have to give them more. I have to give them more opportunity to hear their voice. I got to give them the opportunity to maybe confront me in a way that if it's honest and fair, then I got to listen and I got to be aware of. And I think that was around the time where Gary and Sean and I started to try to develop an off the court relationship. Gerg and I started going out to lunch or going out having a drink with Gary and Sean. You know, maybe not a lot, but I would say maybe three or four times a year, to where they could air their anger or their frustration, or they got their voice heard. Because, you know, we had a crazy situation with Wally and me and the ownership and contracts. And we had a lot of stuff in our locker room that once Gary and Sean knew that I was probably on their, they knew I was on their side, probably more than management side. I think it helped. And from that point forward, I think we moved in a better direction.
So as we look at that season kind of going through it, one of the things I thought was interesting you mentioned on the Sonics Forever pod that came out recently was, you know, kind of the feeling in the city with that 95 Mariners run to the ALCS and that you and your coaching staff are going to a lot of those games. Did that just kind of uplift the city as a whole during that period?
You know, the two best times was the year we went to the finals in Seattle, and the Mariners were pretty good. I don't remember if the Seahawks were, but I know we went to at least three or four Mariner baseball games as a staff. And just walking in that area and feeling that juice, and then going to the NBA finals, the same thing. And then the only other city that I felt had that electricity that Seattle had in that year was Milwaukee. The year I went to the conference finals in Milwaukee when no one thought we were any good. And I think we upset somebody along the way. And we took Philadelphia to a 7-game series. That was a lot of fun, you know, and I thought actually we missed a, Glenn Robinson missed about a 12-foot wide open jump shot in game 5, down 1 with 5 seconds to go. So I thought we were really close to go to the NBA finals with a very good team, but not a very talented team.
Yeah. I mean, that was kind of a forgotten great series, that conference finals between the Bucks and the Sixers. Another thing that I saw that you mentioned that I was kind of interested by is, you know, coming off of those playoff losses and knowing that your future in Seattle was a little uncertain at that point, that you and the coaching staff sort of coached that season loose. What did that mean to you?
My recollection was, you know, my coaching staff was probably being my psychologist. You know, they were constantly telling me, don't let Wally bother you. Don't let Wally get into your head. You know, Wally might not be the greatest guy to work for, but you're also pretty immature here. And so, you know, my commitment was more to, hey, let's rally around the guys in this locker room. That's who we're going to talk to. That's who we're going to have a pulse on. That's who we're going to try to get better. And we can't do anything. And the one thing good about Wally is Wally never talked to me about basketball. You know, he didn't talk to me about almost anything. But he never came in and said, George, I don't like how you're using Gary. Or, I don't like how you're using Sam. That never happened, which that gives me a little bit of a freedom to do what I wanted to do. And damn, we had a hell of a coaching staff. I mean, that those meetings were filled with information. And I think the players knew they were getting better. And the players knew the culture that we had was probably ahead of the time. At that time, NBA guys weren't working as hard as we were working. I think now everybody in the NBA has a culture of development, a culture of working with their players in the summertime. And, you know, Gerg's crazy about summer. I mean, he thinks he can turn a piece of gravel into a diamond if you work hard enough.
Going through that season, one of the key moments, you've mentioned this obliquely, is Gary Payton suffers an ankle sprain. I think it was at Minnesota in late November. And the word we got was, supposed to be out a couple of weeks. You know, that was the anticipation for the injury. He doesn't miss a game. He's back playing 2 days later in a couple of key wins that next weekend that we'll talk about. What was his toughness like?
Top five I've ever been around. I mean, his, you know, Michael Jordan to me has been the greatest competitor I've ever seen in basketball, but also I've been with him in golf courses and I've seen him play poker. I've seen him play ping pong. The man wants to beat you in anything. And Gary in basketball was that way. You know, not only did he want to beat you, he wanted to kind of embarrass you. He wanted to make you feel like you were inferior. And, you know, that was a blessing, man, because that's kind of who I am as a competitor. You know, and the longer I coach Gary, the more I kind of, in a strange way, Gary and I are very similar in many ways. And, you know, we're both outspoken. We're both angry. We were angry competitors. We're physical competitors. You know, I think Gary had much more talent and skill than I ever had. But our makeup was very similar. And I think that was an asset that I realized there also in the osmosis of our relationship. And today, you know, I'm really happy that Gary Payton is going to coach. Yeah. I think he realizes now that, you know, he might not be able to get an NBA job because there's so much competition now for him. So he's going to go prove himself. And I applaud that. I think that's wonderful. I think a lot of great players want to skip steps rather than go do the work to become a good coach. And I'm hoping Gary kicks some butt down in Oakland.
Yeah, we just got that announcement earlier this week that he's coaching at Lincoln University in Oakland. So very cool to hear. The next game after that is a game that I remember a moment from very clearly, which is, so David Robinson, you're playing against the Spurs at home at Key Arena. David Robinson gets ejected for taking a swing at Frank Borkowski, which is very out of character, as we all know, for David Robinson. And then you and Bob Hill, the Spurs coach at the time, kind of get into it on the sidelines. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think I was on the other side of the court. You know, I don't know. Bob Hill triggered me. And I don't know. You know, Bob Hill has – he always was one of those guys that I thought was always was dressed to the hill, looked pretty. Exactly. Everything I did, I couldn't be. He was, from a standpoint of persona and social connection. And yeah, I was, I remember going down there yelling at him. I don't know exactly what I said, but it wasn't nice.
If there had been a fight, he would have been very concerned about messing up his
suit. I would have messed up his hair. I'm sure of that. I would have wrinkled his shirts too. I mean, how about he had perfect, his shirts were perfect.
So he went on to coach the Sonics later. And I remember him in the pregame media availability, like folding another reporter's pocket square. And it was kind of incredible.
I mean, come on, man. Why, we shouldn't even be wearing suits. We should be wearing.
And now finally, you know, has come to pass in the NBA. That was quite a memorable weekend. That game took place Friday night. Sunday, the Chicago Bulls come to town 10-1 with Jordan back for a full season after his first retirement, Dennis Rodman on the roster. And you guys hand them a second loss. Gary Payton comes up with a key steal on Jordan in the closing seconds. Was that a moment that kind of, because you had gotten off to a slow start that season, were 6-5 at one point, a moment that sort of reminded you that you guys could play with anyone?
I think we needed that game. As you said, you know, I don't know why we were searching, but we were. I think our schedule was difficult, to be honest with you, my recollection. But, you know, back then they wanted us to win 60 wins. And so you, blaming the schedule wasn't a part of the gig. But I remember that game gave us confidence. There's no question that I think over an NBA season, there's always a half a dozen, maybe 10 games that stand out that, they, you know, they're more of a must win than most must wins. And that was kind of a must win for us. And it was a hell of a battle. It was, I remember the game was very close, very, you know, very down to the last wire, very physical. I mean, to be honest with you, the Chicago Seattle battles, it wasn't pretty basketball. It was wars. Yes. It was wrestling. It was physicality. It was Rodman versus Kemp, Payton. I mean, you're talking about not only great athletes, but strong athletes and guys that like to defend. And during COVID, I went back and looked at the 7-game series against Chicago. I mean, there might have been one game that Chicago played really good offensively. And there, I think game 5, we played really well offensively. But in the end, it was just a damn good two defensive teams who in the end were stopping each other, and they just stopped us more than we stopped them.
Yeah, we'll get there. But the final scores of the last two games, 89-78 and 87-75. So, yeah, definitely not the scores we're accustomed to today. I think the next key point during that season, Detlef Schrempf goes down in December with a fracture of his lower leg that sidelines him 6 weeks. And you guys are able to kind of keep on going without him, despite the loss of someone we haven't talked about yet, but a really crucial third player on that team to support GP and Kemp.
Yeah, Detlef was the, you know, I think Gary was the glue to our team. Nate was the soul to our team. And Detlef was, I don't know, he was kind of like the fundamental, most efficient player that we had. I mean, Detlef was really, really efficient. And to be honest with you, if he would have played for someone else those last 5 or 6 years, he might have been an all-star. I mean, he would have scored more points. But he wanted to live in Seattle. He wanted to be a part of the Sonics. And he did a great job of being the third fiddle on that team. But I always believe that certain injuries open up your team to learning more about who they are. And I think when Detlef went down, I remember talking to Gary and Sean about, hey, me and you two are now responsible to fill in the hole for Detlef. Now you got to do your jobs. You got to be more focused. You got to be more responsible. And I got to do a better job of handling how we play and who we play and where we play. And I don't remember. I think we did a really good job in that stretch. And Detlef every day was showing everybody on our team how to be a pro, how to rehab an injury, because Detlef was a perfectionist. Detlef wanted to do everything at a high quality, high level of efficiency and effectiveness. And, you know, in a lot of ways, you know, a lot of players kind of resented his perfectionism. But in the same sense, I thought he lifted our team to be more from a year before and kind of the 2 years before how we fell apart. We came more together in that year because of Detlef being such a pro and doing it the right way every day.
And then you take sort of the lessons learned that you talked about during that stretch where he's out, get him back in the lineup, and the result is a 14-game winning streak as you sort of cement yourself atop the Western Conference at that point.
You know, one thing I loved about that team, when we got in flow and when we got playing the right way, we were cocky, but we were also focused. We were demanding of each other. It kind of, you know, it was the season that we kind of policed each other with not a lot of problem. And then when you go on a 14-game winning streak, everybody's happy. You know, everybody's celebrating. So, yeah, those are good days. I hope someone ever, when they ever coach, having a year like that will be great, a great, great resume.
For sure, for sure. That team goes on to finish with 64 wins, but kind of a key moment in the final game of the season, a loss at Denver, is Sean Kemp gets ejected for a fight with Tom Hammonds and suspended for game one against Sacramento. It's kind of a funny situation because today nobody would be playing in that game having locked up the number one seed, but it was kind of different back in the 90s in terms of you played all the way through the tape. And win game one without Kemp, he comes back, you lose game two, and now it's a sense of here we go again in Seattle after those two first round losses. What do you remember between that game two at home in Seattle and then going down to Sacramento for game three and four?
Oh, I think other than losing to Denver, those 2 or 3 days in Sacramento, they were long days. I remember sitting at the pool, I think it's a Hyatt Hotel in Sacramento. And it's just I thought the time was moving so slowly because we just were thinking all and everything was a negative thought. And finally the game came and Sacramento game three came and we were struggling. We were down in the fourth quarter of Sacramento and we had a lot of demons going through our head. And that was the year the arc was moved in. The three-point arc was moved in. And I remember Bukowski and Perkins made a couple threes late in the fourth to win game three. I'm telling you, it might have been in the 2 or 3 minute mark. I mean, that's how close that game was. And then, of course, we came back and win game four. But those, I guess we were in Sacramento for 4 or 5 days. And they were long days. Took a lot of long walks around the circle of the Capitol.
Yeah, you wrote in your book the next year, in my 5 years in Seattle, can't remember a bigger win than game three in Sacramento. I mean, does that still hold looking back?
I think game three and game four, I mean, it lifted us. I mean, yeah, game three, but, you know, we still were trying to get out of the woods. And then when we went game four, then I thought we kind of threw the weight off. And I think we go on to play. Second round was Houston.
Houston, yes.
And I think we beat them four straight.
Yep.
Yeah, my son says we're going to sweep them on Houston TV. I remember that. Yeah. I guess he wasn't listening to those lectures about no bulletin board messages. But no, I kind of knew it was going to be a hell of a year after that. Once we got our past demons off our back.
Yeah, Kobe hopefully has picked up that lesson now that he's in coaching himself with the Lakers G League affiliate. But yeah, I mean, that Houston matchup was one that at that point you guys really dominated, had a lot of success with that Bob Kloppenberg trapping defense against Hakeem Olajuwon, who still was very dominant. But, you know, other teams were kind of forced to choose between, can we double Olajuwon in the post or get out to their shooters? And your defenses in particular were able to kind of take away both of those things in that era.
I don't know when it was, but Hakeem just didn't want to play against us. I don't know. I mean, don't get me wrong. He still played, but he got angry a lot about us. And it's an amazing, I think we beat him like 16 straight times. It's an amazing.
Yeah. At that point it had been 9 straight in the regular season, then the 4 in that series. So yeah, it'd been 13 in a row to that point. I'm not sure about the next season.
I mean, that's pretty powerful stuff. I mean, a team that won championships just a couple years before that. And they were good. And they kept being good. I think they made the Barkley trade the next year. And we had another playoff series the next year. Is it the next year we had another playoff series? Seven-game series against them? It was fun. It was good memories. Thanks for bringing them up.
Yeah, Barkley kind of swung the matchup, because kind of the fascinating thing in that those few years before that was Phoenix had beaten you in the playoffs. Houston had always beaten Phoenix in the playoffs, including those two championship runs they had. And then you knocked Houston out of the playoffs the 2 years surrounding that, 93 and 96. So it's kind of like whatever matchup took place out of those three teams was going to determine who was going to win the West.
Yeah. I mean, Phoenix and us, you know, that was a good triangle of really good basketball teams.
And then the fourth team in the mix, I mean, no disrespect to San Antonio, who is in there too, is the Utah Jazz you end up facing in the conference finals. And sort of, you know, teams that were intertwined as well in the 90s, you faced each other 3 times in 5 years, including your first season as coach. You split the first 2 matchups, and then that 96 Western Conference Finals with the biggest stakes is kind of the rubber match of those three. What was that matchup like with the comparison of you've got Payton and Kemp versus Stockton and Malone? And
Someone should write a story about that matchup. Because the beginning, you know, when I first got to Seattle, we were trapping in Stockton and Malone, and we thought we had, you know, we had some success trapping them. Then they figured our stuff out. And then we didn't. In the year we beat them in the finals, we couldn't trap them. If we trapped them, we would give up a layup or a wide open 3 every time. So the osmosis of Sloan and his staff and my staff, it had like 2 or 3 different chapters to it. And then Stockton, Malone, Kemp, Payton, that kind of had 2 or 3 different chapters to it. You know, where, you know, Carl might have had an advantage on Sean. Sean caught him and maybe went ahead of Carl. Gary and Stockton were more close. But I think early in that game, Stockton had more leadership, and then Gary gained more competent leadership. It's a marvelous. And Sloan and I, in a way, are very similar. And, you know, like I was kind of a, I wasn't a good offense. I mean, I wasn't a good player, but I drifted to defense. And Sloan was a hell of a defensive player, and he drifted to offense because their offense was really, really good.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, certainly a memorable offense. Now, that series, you take a 3-1 lead, which was not maybe, you know, quite the thing, the whole 3-1 concept that it is today with the comebacks we've seen, but they go on to win game 5 in Seattle in overtime and then a blowout in game 6. And, you know, one of the things you've mentioned is in some ways it was a good thing that game 6 was so lopsided because it was easier to kind of just move past it and move on to hosting game 7 at home with the NBA finals spot on the line.
We blew game 5. We didn't have the right attitude. They came in fired up. And game 6, we got kicked. I mean, that game was over before the first quarter was over. And then game 7, I don't think the scoreboard ever got above 5. I don't think the difference in that game ever got above 5. It might have, but I know it didn't get above 10. I mean, it was just a possession game, a low possession game. They know us, we know you. Let's try to figure this out. And it comes down to where Sean makes 2 free throws and Malone misses 2 free throws. It was great.
Now, we've had the counts to 10 or past 10 with Giannis at the free throw line during this year's playoffs. Has it reminded you of Sonics fans chanting that for Karl Malone in that series?
Yeah, it does remind me of it. And in a way, I think all that stuff, Karl didn't, I mean, he didn't release those free throws very well. I mean, it was, you know, it was a great strategy that I told my team to follow him.
He shot 56% on free throws in that series, which was his worst in any 7-game series. And he was a 72% shooter during the 95-96 regular season.
Right.
May have had some effect. You move on to Chicago. What was that matchup like, knowing that, you know, these are two of the teams that have had, at that point, the 10 best records in league history? Chicago, a record 72 wins. What was the message about that matchup?
You know, the matchup was how to score. I mean, they were so good defensively, and they had so many, you know, they had so many different looks that they could give you defensively from a standpoint of the individual talent. You know, and, you know, we never, ever found a very good rhythm offensively. And the only time we really played well was when we created offense with our defense. And we turned them over a little bit, but they weren't a turnover team. And then the triangle has pretty good spacing against double teaming and that type of thing. But, you know, Michael Jordan had one good game. Everybody says Michael, I know he was given the MVP, but I thought Rodman was probably their MVP. I mean, Rodman beat us with his offensive rebounding in a lot. And two of the games we thought we got beat because of rebounding and we couldn't make enough shots.
Yeah. I mean, game 2 of that series, a 4-point game in Chicago, and Rodman comes up with 11 offensive rebounds in that game, including one in the final minute that helped kind of put it away. And then he also, you know, Frank Borkowski, I think the hope was that he would engage with Rodman and distract him, but it seemed like Rodman kind of won that battle in terms of Borkowski getting thrown out and getting technicals.
I mean, Rodman, we, you know, I said, Frank, you take care of Rodman. I don't want to pay any attention to him. And that was Frank's job. He was mad that I didn't start him earlier. But, you know, I go back and look at that thing, and everybody said I should have put Gary on him, on Michael. And if I did it today, I probably would. But I was worried about Gary's health. Gary had a leg injury that, you know, Frank Furtado was telling me today, we got to be careful here. I mean, you might lose him if you play him a lot. And so, you know, Gary never thought about that. He wanted to play every minute of every game. And so whatever I decided, he would have probably bitched about. But, you know, and we switched so much. you know, our defense had a lot of switching in it. So everybody had to cover Michael a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like in like the Last Dance and the popular consciousness nationally, that series has been reduced to that decision, the Peyton Jordan matchup is the primary thing. And what gets lost, I think, is the injuries in that series where Nate McMillan barely was able to play. He played briefly in game one, but then missed game two and game three, comes back for games four and five, the two that you win. And Ron Harper also played limited minutes in all of those games in Seattle. And that kind of changed things from Chicago's standpoint and was one reason you're able to come back and dominate those next two games to force a game six.
Yeah, my belief is if we had a healthy Nate, that would have been a seven-game series. I really believe that. You know, as I said before, Gary was kind of the heart. Sean was the talent. Nate was our soul. I mean, the guys listen to Nate more than they listen to me. I mean, when they talk, they listen. And he played, I mean, in game four and five, he didn't play great. But we had the confidence to win those games pretty well. You know, I'm not saying we dominated those games, but we had somewhat of a control of those games. And then game six, he couldn't go. He just couldn't go.
Yeah, I mean, the other factor that kind of gets forgotten is how important Nate was, because you just felt it seemed like you kind of ran out of guys you could trust on the court. Irvin Johnson, you know, gets out of the rotation in that series, and then Vincent Askew as well. It's kind of one of the things you see in the playoffs where the level of competition gets so high that you find out there's only a certain number of guys who can keep up. Is that fair?
Yeah, we ran out of players. Our bench got depleted for whatever reason. I think we actually started playing David Wingate some.
Yep.
In the series, just because he would play the right way and play with a lot of enthusiasm and had courage to go against Michael. But we ran out of gas. We ran out of talent when Nate went down. Vinny acted goofy and did whatever he did. And then we cut Irvin out of the rotation and put Frank in. So I love that series, but I'll be honest with you. It's not something you should go and watch to be artistically. I mean, it's a wrestling match more than it is pretty basketball.
Now you mentioned at the start of this, you know, guys talking about getting together to remember that season. How much are you in touch with players from that 95-96 team?
You know, not a lot. I mean, if I tried to stay in touch with all the guys I connected, I'd be on the phone for 6 hours every day. Gary and I are still pretty tight. I try, when I go to Seattle, every once in a while, I see Det and Sean. Sam and I have connected through Carolina stuff along the way. But all the other guys, it's always a lot of fun to kind of run into those guys when I do. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But you know, I've been blessed. I've coached 2,000 games and I wish I would have done a better job of connecting with those guys, but I would like to get, I hope we have some type of celebration to celebrate all of them along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mentioned the Truth in Basketball podcast you co-host, but the Truth in Media network now includes the Sonics Forever podcast that you're doing with Simply Sonics, and season two with Mike Gastineau has been great. You came in and recorded an episode at Dick's with your son and Bob Whitsitt. How did that podcast come together?
So I did my podcast on the Sonics, and one of my entrepreneurs who put this thing together lived in Seattle. And he saw the numbers were our best numbers were in Seattle. So he kind of wanted to branch out and do a little bit on his own. And it worked. It worked really well. And the numbers are still good. And it kind of coincides with 25 years and hopefully getting an NBA team back in Seattle. That's what we all want to do right now. Get a team back in Seattle. That's the goal, people. Please keep pounding the doors. Keep making it happen.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to the love that still exists for the Sonics, in particular for that era in Seattle.
Right.
Well, George, we appreciate so much you taking the time to talk with us and go back down memory lane a little bit here. And again, encourage everyone to listen to the Truth in Basketball podcast and Sonics Forever.
Kevin, I thank you very much. And I had fun going back and telling a lot of stories. Hopefully I didn't embellish too much.
We'll go back and fact check it after.
Okay, man. Thank you, Kevin.